Psalm 106 is where we will be. Well, that was not my best move, was it? Say what?
Gravity,
yes. I tried to lift that and just tipped it right over. One too many Wheaties, I guess. I want to mention this in Sunday school, and I'll mention it in the morning service, but Dwayne Straw could use some help tonight, a couple of guys to help him move a freezer. They just live up the street, so they're nice and close, so if you might be able to do that. And like I said, I'm going to mention it in the morning and evening service. We'll try and get him some help there. Man, everything went crashing. Well, it's good to have you here. This is just not going to be my morning, is it? I think I need to change podiums. No, I'm just going to get this up here where I want it. How far did I go there? All right. Psalm 106, and not a very holiday, although we're going to be kind of holiday, I guess, in the morning service. But we had spent some time talking about deacons, and I have one more Sunday school lesson that I'm kind of thinking, debating about whether or not I will bring along that line, but you know, we've got, in addition to folks gone today, with the holiday, we've got folks out today with illness. And so, I know that the choir's been hit, you know, pretty good with that. And so, and some other folks. So, you know, so anyway, we'll get into the first of the year and, we'll start, the process of adding a deacon and dealing with that, and I may come back and talk about that. And I had passed around a little bit of a sign-up sheet and just kind of soliciting your interest for Sunday school. And one of the things, and I may mention this, one of the things that has come up was marriage, and that was, you know, pretty substantially addressed. And so I'm really kind of thinking through and debating exactly how I want to handle that, and we'll deal with that. And another thing that showed up as fairly popular, I had just kind of highlighted ethical issues. And that showed up as fairly popular, and I thought maybe I would tackle some of that. But as I began to work on it, I realized that was a pretty broad area. And what I'm thinking of in terms of ethical issues may not be what you're thinking of in terms of ethical issues. And so I'm going to kind of throw that back on you, and I guess particularly for those of you who expressed interest in it, or maybe now that we're, you know, kind of committed to it for the near future, however long it will be, and I have no specific idea in mind. What I want to do in doing it is cover all of the bases that you would hope we would touch on. And so if you would give me some feedback as to what specific thing or issue you have questions about or intrigue you, then we can kind of tackle that. You know, I've got a couple of Sunday school lessons ready on, I guess, what I think are two of the more prevalent, I guess, with relationship to our culture, you know, today, abortion. And then I've got one put together on capital punishment. But there are all kinds of things that this could touch on. So if you, if you don't mind to give me some feedback on that, you can either write it out, or if, you know, something jumps to your mind right now, you can just yell it out to me. Or you can just give me the blank stare that I'm becoming so accustomed to. All right, let's pray then, and we're gonna kind of dive into this this morning. God, I pray that you would help us in this time. Thank you for your word, and Lord, help us to remember always that our faith plays out in very real ways, in our personal relationships, in our work relationships, in our place as citizens, within our city and our state and our nation. And I pray that we would have understanding from you about what we should believe and how we should act and how we should think about these things. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So this morning then, thinking along this, I thought I would start with what is perhaps the most obvious, and one really that I don't know that I've ever given a lot of thought to, as far as dedicated, thinking through and discussing of the issue. But we're gonna touch on some things, and some of that is that, I feel like my obligation is more, teaching the Bible, which certainly includes relating it to what's going on in the culture, rather than just to deal with cultural issues. And so, I got some stuff here, but we're not going to get into the horrific aspects of abortion, because quite honestly, there I don't think that they're germane to the topic at all. So that would be my assessment. Okay, so abortion, historically, this is not something that's new to America. Abortion has been practiced by many cultures throughout history. It existed in the Roman times. Apart from the fact that Jesus was God and, as God knew everything, Jesus lived in a world in which people attempted it. They may have been, we certainly have, technological capabilities today that the Romans didn't have, but that has never stopped people from trying to practice certain things. So many cultures have practiced a form of abortion. It has what? Oh, it has been legally protected in the United States since the infamous Roe v. Wade Supreme Court case in 1973. Which, by the way, primarily was not really about abortion as much as it was about a constitutional right to privacy. And actually, Sandra Day O'Connor, in one of her rulings, gave much more, legal footing to abortion than it had ever existed under Roe. When the state ruled in Roe v. Wade, every state had some form of anti-abortion law that had been on the books for many, many years. And different states had different laws regulating or banning, prohibiting abortion. I'm not exactly sure I'd say it. I'd call it Guttmacher Institute. And I put the web address up there. All of my statistics are off of their website. It is a secular website that is dedicated, I'm trying to remember, if I can't remember their exact tagline, but they're dedicated to reproductive health by public education, by policy. So I went to them rather than, something that, because I just felt like their statistics, I'm not going to say are less biased, but if they're biased, they're going to be more biased in favor of abortion rather than, in theory, they're just kind of a informational agency that is not necessarily pro or against, but is just trying to protect, those, people and to educate with reference to it. So the Guttmacher Institute estimates that 53 million abortions have been performed since Roe v. Wade. These are all in the United States. So that since 1973, in these 41 years, there have been 53 million abortions performed in the United States. According to Guttmacher, and here's just a whole list of statistics, and some of this I got right from, from their website, and some of it I just cut and pasted, so it's got some of their notations. 18% of U.S. women obtaining abortions are teenagers. 15 to 17-year-olds obtain 6% of all abortions, 18 to 19-year-olds 11%, and teens younger than 15 obtain 0.04%. This is one of their stats. Women in their 20s account for more than half of all abortions. Women aged 20 to 24 obtain 33% of all abortions. Women aged 25 to 29 obtain 24%. So, non-Hispanic white women account for 36% of abortions. Non-Hispanic black women for 30%, Hispanic women for 25%, and women of other races for 9%. 37% of women attaining abortions identified themselves as Protestant, and 28% identified themselves as Catholic. Women who have never married and are not cohabitating account for 45% of all abortions. About 61% of abortions are obtained by women who have one or more children. 42% of women obtaining abortions have incomes below 100% of the federal poverty level, which is $10,830 annual income for a single woman with no children. 27% of women obtaining abortions have incomes between 100 and 199% of the federal poverty level, so somewhere between $10,800 and $5,415. The reason women give for having an abortion underscores their understanding of the responsibilities of parenthood and family life. Remember, this is a secular institution providing its findings. So, three-fourths of the women cite concern for or responsibility to other individuals. Three-fourths say they cannot afford a child. Three-fourths say that having a baby would interfere with work, school, or the ability to care for dependents. Half say they do not want to be a single parent or are having problems with their husband or partner. So societies, like the United States, defend and support abortion for a variety of reasons. Another study that was conducted in 1998 but went back into the years 1987 through 1988, revealed that women reported the following as their primary reason for choosing an abortion. Okay? The source of this information takes findings into account from 27 different nations, including the United States. So almost 26% want to wait till they have a child. 21.3% say they can't afford a baby. 14% have a relationship problem or a partner who doesn't want a baby. 12.2% say they're too young or their parents or someone else object to the pregnancy. 10.8% report having a child will disrupt their education or their job. 7.9% don't want any more children. 3.3% are concerned about the baby's health. 2.8% are concerned about the mother's health. And 2.1% list other reasons. So I went through all that, folks, because, I mean, what do statistics matter? Abortion should not be the kind of thing that is relegated to the rule of a Democratic majority. And as soon as we begin to justify moral conduct on the basis of the majority, right? Then, I mean, look, we're pretty much all familiar with, you know, and I'm sure I'm not going to get the exact quote right, but, you know, democracies will work fine until people realize that they can vote themselves funds from the public purse, okay? So what's the economic ruin of the United States going to be? Absolutely blatantly what the economic ruin of the United States is already heading to be. We can vote ourselves somebody else's money. And so we don't care how we pay it back. You know, I have the ability to get money from you, and I want it, and so you owe it to me, and so there's the end of the conversation. And I'm going to, you know, we spend a lot of time yelling at Congress without ever taking responsibility for the fact that Congress is a reflection of the people who are electing them. In other words, they're mouthpieces for the people. Why do we keep voting these people in? Because there are lots of people who want somebody in Washington to give them money. All right, so there's our economic ruin. When we do the same thing with our morality, we're gonna reach the same kind of conclusions. Right? As soon as a nation's moral basis becomes the will of the majority of the people, that country is in serious trouble. you know, I think, by the way, I think that many of us as Christians understand this, which is why you find so many Christians passionately trying to, you know, to get the laws changed, because we recognize that we do have, at least we believe we have as Americans, the right to legislate our own morality. So all those statistics are just simply reflections of the logic that people employ. How do you defend an abortion? I can't afford this child. It will interfere with my life. My spouse doesn't want it, or my significant other doesn't want it, or, you know, I have too many children. You know, on and on and on it goes. All of these, you know, incredibly rational sounding, right? I mean, if you just, you know, if you just think about them in those terms, if you, which is hard for us to do, if you just remove God from the picture, right? I mean, I think if you took God out of the picture, you'd be hard-pressed to make an argument against abortion. I mean, it seems to me that God is the significant argument. And so, you know, when everything else becomes a convenience. So, is there any biblical perspective? And so, I'm going to choose to call your attention to the portion of the 106th Psalm. Psalm 106, and you'll notice that Psalm 105 and Psalm 106 are both rather long poems. Both of them are descriptive of the history of the nation of Israel. Psalm 106, you know, there's some differences, and, you know, we're not really going to get into all of that. But Psalm 106 portrays the history of Israel, emphasizing three elements of Israel's history. Number one, its repeated patterns of sin. This has been the perpetual conduct of Israel. Generation after generation after generation after generation, sin. Okay? Which, because they are God's covenant people, then are followed by repeated patterns of God's judgment upon them for their sin. Right? God keeps visiting these people with afflictions and sins and punishments because of their perpetual unfaithfulness. And then this psalm also reflects God's pattern of repeated mercy. I mean, so this is the pattern. The people sin, God judges them, they cry out to God, and He heals them, or He restores them. And this has been their pattern. And by the way, this is one of the things that is interrupted by the Babylonian captivity, is that God has never dealt with them like this before, this severely, to this extent. Okay? Oh, man, I just hate it when I make this kind of typos. So if you could turn to verse 486 in Psalm 106. Psalm 32, or verse number 32. They angered him also at the waters of strife, so that it went ill with Moses for their sakes, because they provoked his spirit, so that he spake unadvisedly with his lips. They did not destroy the nations concerning whom the Lord commanded them, but were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. And they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils, and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. Thus were they defiled with their own works, and went to whoring with their own inventions. Therefore was the wrath of the Lord kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance, and he gave them into the hand of the heathen, and they that hated them ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their hand. So this is that pattern. Okay, in verses 32 through 39, you have their repeated sin. I mean, this is the history of Israel and its relationship with other nations. And in verses 40 through 42, you have God's repeated hand of judgment. And then in verses, which we didn't read, verses 43 through 46, you have God's repeated acts of mercy. Verse 43, many times did he deliver them, but they provoked him with their counsel and were brought low for their iniquity. Nevertheless, he regarded their affliction when he heard their cry, and he remembered for them his covenant and repented according to the multitude of his mercies. So this is the pattern that Israel follows. And so there is a pattern to their sin. And this is a reference back to what happened in Numbers chapter 20, when Israel was dissatisfied with God's provision. They didn't like what God was doing for them. They believed, as we are inclined to believe, that God had let them down. So Israel was disobedient to God by mixing with the nations instead of destroying them. If you look at verses 34 and 35, they did not destroy the nations concerning whom the Lord commanded them. Now, with reference, folks, to something like abortion, and I'm going to try and make the point that you can apply this to, it's not about abortion, but you can apply it to abortion. So we start with an important principle, and that is that not all killing is intrinsically wrong. And again, I realize that we understand that. But, you know, we would be really, in many ways, just the polar opposite of many lost people, because they would support abortion and protest capital punishment. By the way, did you hear what happened in Argentina this week? There is, in a zoo in Argentina, a gorilla that was born in captivity. Evidently, a very shy gorilla, because this gorilla is prone to cover its head with a cloth or a towel when people come to the zoo to see it. And so animal rights activists went to court on behalf of this gorilla and declared it, and had it declared in an Argentinian court, a non-human person. Are you okay there, Mary? And that this animal is being deprived of its right to dignity. This is NPR this morning, folks. I'm not making this up. And that if nobody appeals the decision, this animal will be taken to a sanctuary in Brazil where it will have more freedom and not be the object of scrutiny as it would be in the zoo. And one of the lawyers said, this is a great victory for animal rights and for all who would oppress animals, whether they be in zoos or whether they be in laboratories. I mean, this is where we are. This is where we are as a world. That a gorilla has a right to not be uncomfortable by being put on display in a zoo because it's a non-human person. So, what do you even say? What do you even say? I mean, so anyway, I recognize that we are 180 degrees from much of the lost world who believes that abortion is legitimate and a right and capital punishment is a terrible wrong. Whereas the Bible would argue capital punishment is a mandate upon any civilization, and the killing of innocent life is abhorrent for any nation to allow. So, I mean, we are as a civilization, we are totally at the opposite end of God's thinking. We haven't deviated marginally, we have deviated radically from God's assessment of the world and God's interpretation of justice. Okay? So anyway, the psalm is pretty clear that if God commands the killing, it is not an immoral death. And I mean, that would be, when we deal with capital punishment, that's just the conclusion we'll have to reach. If God commands the killing, it cannot possibly be an immoral death. That's the great difference, folks. What's the difference between capital punishment and abortion? God commands one and condemns the other. That's the only difference. If it's just a simple majority decision or a matter of pragmatism and practicality or cultural norm, then all bets are off. It has to, it must rest upon God or it rests upon nothing. Okay? So here is the pattern to their sin. Israel is dissatisfied, verses 32 and 33. They did not destroy the nations concerning whom the Lord commanded them, but were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. Israel was disobedient to God by mixing with the nations instead of destroying them. This was the command. Okay? You guys go out. You know, we think of God as some kind of horrific brute, but this was God's command. You go out and you kill these nations. You destroy them and their idolatrous practices. You don't embrace them. You don't make treaties with them. You don't make alliances with them. You don't have anything to do with them. You are a self-contained unit. All that you need, I have. That was God's assessment. Did they do that? No, not ever. Not ever. And then in verses 36 through 38, they then practiced the idolatry of the people that they should have destroyed. They served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan. And the land was polluted with blood. And so, verse 39, thus were they defiled with their own works and went whoring with their own inventions. This is them. So God's condemnation of Israel is, folks, very strong, and I would propose very clear. Notice what God says. He says in verse 37, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters. They sacrificed them. They sacrificed them to devils. They shed innocent blood. They polluted themselves. They defiled themselves. They went whoring. I mean, so if you think, well, you know, because a lot of times, you know, people seem to think that God is some kind of heavenly being who is just rather flexible and pliable and doesn't really believe anything strongly. Okay? So this is pretty clear that whatever Israel was doing, God found incredibly disturbing. You could point out, right? I mean, I would point out as I'm preparing to deal with this with you, that this was Israel that God was talking about, and God wasn't talking about any other nation. And that, by the way, would be true. Right? God acknowledges the idolatry of other nations. God condemns all idolatry. But the idolatry of other nations in the Old Testament was not a violation of their covenant with God because they had no covenant with God. Israel's big sin was that they broke the bonds of their covenant. So, I mean, you have all of the things that they would do that were wrong to do in and of themselves. But then you add to that this with Israel, that they are violating the terms of the covenant. They've made a promise that they wouldn't do those things. So not only have they done them, they've added to this the fact that they've broken the covenant. You could also point out that this is no stated link to abortion. And I just want to make sure that we all understand that we're not talking about people having abortions in Psalm 106. The sacrificing of a child to a devil was not via having an abortion. It was the simple and direct act of offering up one of your living children in sacrifice to a false deity. Okay? So if you pointed those things out, you would be right. But I would also argue then you're only partially right. You're right about those things, but what does that mean, or what limits does that have? So again, as I've already just discussed, and you know, we're rehashing what we know here, folks. Israel is unique because of its covenant relationship to God, not because of its action toward or reactions to God. Israel is unique because of its covenant relationship with God. And so let me add to that. In other words, Even Gentile nations think and behave this way about God. This is what is clearly being taught in Romans chapter 1, which has nothing to do with Israel or the Jew. So, out of all of humanity, God had a covenant relationship with one nation, but every nation has a relationship with God because God is the maker of all mankind. And God formed all nations, Acts 17. And God established their boundaries and the times of people's habitations. In other words, folks, you and I were born in America in the 20th, most likely, and for some of your children, the 21st century, for the same reason that David was born in Israel when he was born, because God made him then. So, I was conceived and born in 1957 because this was when God did it. And I was born in America because that was God's doing. And even though I had no interest at all in God and nothing whatsoever to do with God until the day of my salvation, virtually nothing at all to do with God that I was aware of, I'm still God's creation and I still am responsible to Him. So there is a pattern to all human behavior, even if they're not Israelites. And that is, they reject the truth about God. They fabricate their own mindset about God. And therefore, they are under the condemnation of God. And I said this last week or a couple of weeks ago. I mean, this is the pattern for all human beings. They express it differently, but the pattern is always the same. They reject God, and they worship what God made. That's the pattern. Lost people reject God, worship what God made. So that the authoritative relationship gets transposed. That they dictate to God. I will worship God in this way. I will do this. This is what I believe. This is what I've always been taught. This is my tradition. This is how I view it. That is the relationship that people have. Okay? I'm going to add to this, folks, and I just don't know how to persuade you of this. Maybe this would be worth exploring in some detail in some way. But one of the greatest myths that Satan has ever foisted upon modern man is the belief that a secular society can exist. That there is such a thing as a non-religious society. And I would just argue to you that the Bible never opens the door, even a crack, for there to be some group of people somewhere who are a-religious. There is none. All people worship. All people ascribe value to something, supreme value. And I would just argue that our society, again, you know, we have, as only Americans have been able to do, we are the most sophisticated idolaters that have ever existed in the world. We have just bypassed hand carving little stone statues and gone right to the heart of idolatry. We worship ourselves, and we worship what makes us feel good, and we worship what we can think, and we worship what we can imagine, and we worship only what we can conceive or what we imagine we can prove, and, you know, because it's all about science, don't you know? You know, it's all about what you can prove in a laboratory, what you can duplicate somewhere. And the fact that we've built this entire system on things that cannot be duplicated, the fact that we are regularly bombarded with studies that contradict other studies and evidences of science that are not necessarily flattering or corrupted, you know, or blatant, flagrant lies, we nevertheless believe the system because this is our core religion. And this is what is argued in Romans 1:18. All right? So, how would abortion then parallel this. And that would be my argument, that it parallels it. This isn't a passage about abortion, but this is a passage in which the mindset that defends abortion exists. And I think that I would be comfortable arguing that this would be the way that God would view it. That if you said to God, tell me why you're opposed to abortion, he would make these arguments. Number one, it is a sacrifice. Folks, I would argue to you that abortion is a religious sacrifice. What is a sacrifice? A sacrifice is to give up something of value for something of greater value. Right? I mean, if you don't give up something of value, it's not really a sacrifice. Right? I mean, did any of you grow up in a liturgical world? Did anybody grow up like that? Did anybody grow up in a world where you practiced, observed Lent? When it was time to give up something for Lent, what were you expected to give up? Something of value or something of no value? Now, I'm not asking what you did. I'm asking what was expected at the observation of Lent, right? I mean, my wife grew up in a Lutheran home. Right? I mean, if I said to you, we're going to observe Lent, and everybody's going to give up something of value, and I'm going to lead the way, I'm going to give up the eating of liver. What? Not much of a sacrifice, says Steve Anderson. I guess it would depend on how much you like liver. I don't like liver with onions. I don't like liver with bacon. I like liver when it's a functioning internal organ, and then after that, I'm all done with it. My dad liked liver, which is another subject which may explain a lot of what's wrong with me, because we ate it periodically because my dad liked it. And this is how I know that I don't like it with onions, and I don't like it with bacon, and I don't like it with gravy, and I don't like it with anything else that I've ever had. In other words, folks, I mean, so to give up something that has no value to you can never be construed as a sacrifice. So you give up something that has value so that you may obtain something of greater value. This is the goal, right? To demonstrate, right? I mean, this is the idea of the sacrifice. Here is something that has value that I'm going to surrender to demonstrate that something has greater value. Abortion is a sacrifice, then, in the vast majority of instances. When you go back and read the explanations of why lost people have abortions, they are explaining to you the logic of their sacrifice. That there are things that have greater value. Right? Is a baby... Right? I mean, we devalue it because we won't call it a baby. We call it a fetus. Right? Because that's one of the ways that we help to balance the equation. We'll just call it a fetus. We'll devalue it. And my ability to fund it is more important than its survival. The size of my family is of greater value than adding a child. Whatever the reasons are, it is a sacrifice. There are very few people, folks, that have had abortions forced upon them. There are very few people that have been in that situation. Most people volunteer to have them. They are choices. They are value judgments. They are, therefore, sacrificial in their nature. I'm giving this up because there are things that are to me of greater value than this. So, in the last 41 years, 53 million times in America alone, a living human being has come out on the losing end of the value judgment. I don't know any other way to put that. It's a sacrifice. Okay? How does abortion parallel Israel's sins? What does God say? They sacrifice their sons and their daughters. I mean, these were living human beings. For the Israelites, they didn't do it to fetuses. They did it to children. They would literally offer their children in the fire. Sacrifices to obtain the favor of the gods. Family. Sons, daughters, individuals, little boys, little girls. How does abortion parallel Israel's sin? They shed innocent blood. You know, folks, in light of the fact that God views all men as guilty in Adam, that's really a powerful statement. In what way are they innocent? They are innocent in that they have done nothing that is worthy of their death. That's how they're innocent. He's not saying that had they been born, they would have been free from the sin nature. But did they do anything worthy of death? What death does a conceived child deserve? No matter how poor the mother, no matter how bad the relationship, under what code of ethics does that child deserve to die? So to this extent, I would argue that it parallels abortion. They shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and of their daughters. This is why they were sacrificed. How does abortion parallel Israel's sin? They sacrificed to devils. 1 Corinthians 10:19-20, Paul's talking about, he's continuing a discussion that he raised in 1 Corinthians 8 about eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols. A clear reference to a cultural practice of the Romans having a feast, killing an animal, offering part of that animal up in sacrifice to a Roman god, and then eating the rest of it, having the neighborhood over for a barbecue. Can a Christian eat that meat? That was the question. The Corinthians were, sure, what's the big deal? And Paul starts off by dancing around that question. Yeah, let's probe what is the big deal. And God comes to this conclusion. Well, let me tell you what the big deal is. The big deal is that animal that they sacrificed is my animal, not theirs. And the big deal is that animal that they sacrificed to their statue, they were actually sacrificing to a demon and not to me. Therefore, it's a big deal to me and I don't want you to eat it. That was God's logic. Took three chapters in the Bible to develop it, Romans or 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, but that was the conclusion. You can't do that. You can't do that. Okay? They are sacrificing to devils. And again, folks, I would just argue that you should never, ever, ever buy into the myth or believe in the myth that this is somehow a secular society. And by the way, I would argue that the religious tone of American culture, the scientific mentality, is its absolute intolerance of biblical Christianity. They know we're the competition. We're the ones who don't always understand it. They know there are two incompatible worldviews. A lot of Christians think that they can be a secularist sometimes and a Christian sometimes, but you can't be. You've got to pick one. You've got to pick one or the other. Satan was a murderer from the beginning, John chapter 8 and verse number 44. He was a murderer from the beginning. Every murder is somehow and in some way connected to Lucifer, the first murderer. These children are being sacrificed to devils. So, I think the Bible speaks clearly about abortion being wrong. And more than just, I mean, I would argue that abortion is wrong because life belongs to God, but there's a lot more to it than that. Abortion is not just simply disposing of an unborn child for some logical reason. It is a religious sacrifice that is made, that is a reflection of an idolatrous heart. That would be my logic and argument for that. Okay, questions, comments, observations?